From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Twenty years after selling his first cartoon to the New Yorker magazine, Robert Mankoff became the New Yorker's cartoon editor. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with him about the art and craft of cartooning. It's the subject of his new book, The Naked Cartoonist. Also, we talk with two of the people behind the very funny satirical newspaper, The Onion, editor Robert Siegel and writer Carol Kolb. And film critic John Powers reviews Solaris, starring George Clooney. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has named former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger to lead an investigation into the September 11th attacks. Kissinger promised to follow the facts wherever they might lead and said his panel would not be restricted by any foreign policy considerations. He said the investigation would include possible ties between Saudi Arabia and the Al-Qaeda terrorist network. Critics, such as the Federation of American Scientists, cited war crimes allegations against Kissinger stemming from his role in the Vietnam War and the U.S.-backed coup in Chile. Democrats named Senator George Mitchell as chairman of the panel. Mitchell pledged to make the commission's inquiry fair and nonpartisan. President Bush has approved a plan to provide smallpox vaccinations to about 1 million U.S. military personnel and civilian medical workers. That word today from U.S. officials who tell NPR the vaccination plan could be announced sometime next week. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
The smallpox vaccination program due to be announced soon would be the first of its kind here in 30 years. 500,000 military personnel would be vaccinated, according to U.S. officials, along with another 500,000 civilians. Those due to be vaccinated include frontline troops who could be exposed to the smallpox virus in Iraq. U.S. intelligence experts believe Saddam Hussein has smallpox samples and could use them in biological weapons. The military vaccination plan was presented to the White House earlier this month by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. The civilian, emergency, and medical workers to be vaccinated include people who would be among the first to respond to a bioweapons attack here at home. A U.S. official says President Bush has approved the plan, but there's no decision yet on how or when to announce the program. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush has given Mexican trucks a green light to travel U.S. highways, ending a long-standing point of contention between the two nations. NPR's Jerry Haddon reports from Mexico City.
Mexican trucks have been banned from most U.S. roads since 1982. They were to have been given free access under the 1994 NAFTA agreement, but the Clinton administration blocked them, citing safety concerns and opposition from organized labor. Bush's decision to allow the trucks comes just a day after high-level talks in Mexico City. Those talks achieved no breakthroughs on other sensitive issues, such as Mexican migration to the U.S. or U.S. farm subsidies. Mexican trucks are currently restricted to a 20-mile border zone where they transfer their cargo to American trucks for further transport. Trucks that will now travel deeper into the U.S. will have to pass strict safety inspections. The Department of Transportation says Mexican trucks could be operating freely north of the border within a month. Jerry Haddon, NPR News, Mexico City.
In stocks, the Dow gained 255 points, almost 3%, to close at 8932. The Nasdaq gained 44 points. This is NPR News. Members of the International Machinists Union are voting today on whether to accept $1.5 billion in wage concessions as part of an effort to keep United Airlines from bankruptcy. The machinists are the only employee group that hasn't officially voted on wage cuts. The company says the concessions are necessary if United is to get a federal loan guarantee that will keep it in business. The union represents more than 37,000 United workers, including mechanics and baggage handlers. A class action lawsuit has been filed against the city of Detroit on behalf of hundreds of thousands of people whose Social Security numbers were mistakenly made public. Quinn Kleinfelter reports from member station WDET.
A year ago, the city of Detroit inadvertently mailed tax forms with the recipient's Social Security number printed on the outside of the envelope. Now a class action lawsuit filed on behalf of about 400,000 people seeks more than $400 million in damages for gross negligence, violating the 1974 Federal Privacy Act, and exposing Detroiters and those who work in the city to potential credit card fraud. The suit also seeks money for individuals to track their credit reports. Last January, Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick publicly apologized for the mailings and said he would investigate how the mistake occurred. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
Another high-speed internet services provider has filed for bankruptcy. Analysts said Genuity Incorporated failed because of the weak economy and an oversupply of high-speed data transmission services. Genuity said it has agreed to sell most of its assets to one of its competitors, Level 3 Communications. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of natural vitamin E, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the current edition of The New Yorker, there's a cartoon in which a lawyer is saying to his client, "What we're going to say to the jury is, love the embezzler, hate the embezzlement." Many people think of the cartoons as their favorite part of The New Yorker. My guest Robert Mankoff has been the magazine's cartoon editor since 1997. He got the job 20 years after he sold his first cartoon to The New Yorker. Mankoff has edited several collections of the magazine's cartoons, including its 75th anniversary collection. He's also the founder and editor of the internet cartoon database, The Cartoon Bank. Now Robert Mankoff has a new book called The Naked Cartoonist about the art and craft of cartooning. Robert Mankoff, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you to describe your most famous cartoon.
All right. Well, here is my most famous cartoon. It's quite simple, and maybe that accounts for its fame. There's a guy on the phone. He's an executive, clearly a busy executive. He's pointing to his Rolodex, and he's got his phone to his ear, and he's saying, "No, Thursday's out. How about never? Is never good for you?" I know from statistics assiduously compiled that's my favorite cartoon because that's the one people license the most, that's the one they buy prints of, and that's the one when I'm at a party and they say, "You know what cartoon of yours I like best?" And I say, I do know what it is, and I tell them that, and I'm right.
Why do you think it struck a chord?
I think it was in 1993, and it seemed to sort of symbolize just that. The hectic, harried nature of our lives, where we're constantly meeting and associating with people which we often don't want to associate with, and we're trying to obfuscate and say the polite thing, and this somehow was really saying what people were really thinking on some of these phone calls.
You know, songwriters are always asked what comes first, the words or the music. So talking to you, the cartoonist, I am curious if the words always come first, or if sometimes you get the picture first and then you have to figure out what to say. With it.
With me, it's the music. Oh, I forgot. I'm not a songwriter. It's, as you would imagine, it can be either one, or sometimes it's an amalgam. It's half of a word, half of a picture, and then during the process of drawing or thinking, they both sort of come together. I don't know if I've exactly answered the question, but it's almost any conceivable variant of the process can occur.
You became the cartoon editor of The New Yorker in 1997. Why don't you just describe what the job is?
It's an interesting job. It's not, I guess, what people think. Often when I go around and I give talks or people find out I'm a cartoon editor, they said, "Well, that's the greatest job in the world." Imagine it that it's something like, I don't know, being a candy taster. You know, or eating all the best food, you know, the food you really love. And it's a great job because I love cartoons, but the process by which, well, I'll give you for an example, like on a normal week, I will see 34 or 40 contributors to the magazine who do cartoons, and I'll see cartoons that unsolicited and solicited cartoons, you know, by mail. I might look at 1,000 cartoons in 2 days. So when I'm looking at the cartoons, it's probably taking me about 10 seconds or less to look at each cartoon. And at that point, just in a preliminary way, decide, do we want to use it? Do I like it? Is there something there? And then I'm going to go back and look at them again. But I'm not laughing, or almost rarely. I'm sort of just processing. There's so much to look at. And if I went on sort of some sort of, you know, gut instinct, like, am I laughing at the cartoon? Well, it would be sort of like if you were tasting bonbons and you were trying to judge them and you were saying, gee, this is this thousandth bonbon. Why doesn't it taste as good as the fifth? It wouldn't make any sense. So I try to bring some sort of principles to just the initial selection of the cartoons. Then after I make a selection out of about 1,000 of maybe 50 cartoons that I then take in an art meeting and I show to David Remnick, and we have baskets, yes, no, and maybe. And then David and I and sometimes
he's the editor of The New Yorker.
The editor of The New Yorker, basically choose the cartoons. And in the end, David chooses them. He's got to pick out of these bunch which ones he thinks makes overall sense for the magazine. And we have differences of opinion. And, you know, sometimes he gives in to me, but he's usually the editor, so he usually gets his way.
So you have to have criteria because, as you said, the thousandth bonbon isn't as tasty
right.
as the first. So what are your criteria? Could you put it into words?
Sure. Or I can draw a picture, but you couldn't see it. So, although I like this whole idea of sort of the radio cartoon network where I talk cartoons. and a laugh track might be helpful, too. Well, the first criteria I have for the cartoon is it communicating some idea through the medium of humor? Is it demonstrating, you know, not just funniness, but thinking? Is it making some point? And, of course, we do cartoons that are just silly and just funny. But overall, I think the enduring nature of the New Yorker cartoons is that they strike a chord in someone. People remember them because they make some sort of point. So I'm looking for that, the communication of an idea. Secondly, if it's someone who's new, I'm looking. Do they have a distinctive voice? You know, are they doing their own cartoons, or are they, you know, did they basically see a Roz Chask cartoon and think, oh, I can do Roz Chask cartoons? And then thirdly, whether or not how funny the cartoon is not to me always the ultimate criteria. Is, for example, if a cartoon is on a topic that's been beaten to death, then it's got to be very funny. While if it's on some topic that's never been discussed before for the first time, then as far as I'm concerned, I'll say, well, yeah, let's use this cartoon. No one has ever done a cartoon about the fact that men don't like hair on their back or whatever it is.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Mankoff. He is a cartoonist, and he's the cartoon editor for The New Yorker magazine. He has a new book called The Naked Cartoonist. When you first became the cartoon editor at The New Yorker, were you in the position of editing people who had been your heroes and sometimes being even in the position of having to reject their work?
Yeah, I was in that position and also in the position of editing and having to accept and reject the work of my friends as well. That is a difficult situation. It occurred with the previous cartoon editor, Lee Lorenz, who is still a cartoonist and was a cartoonist when he was cartoon editor, as well. But, I mean, in the end, you have to decide either to do the job or not. And what I tell everybody, and whether really they're my friend or a longtime contributor or really no matter how famous, is that it's a cliche, but it's the work that counts.
What's the editing process like? Do you work with cartoonists on improving the work, or making it funnier, changing the drawing?
Well, very little, because one of the things is that the cartoonists submit 10 or 15 ideas every week. And it's a little bit like a type of haiku, you know what I mean? You can fiddle with it a little bit, but one of the things especially that's evolved in the New Yorker cartoon is this idea of authenticity. The cartoons, I would say, I mean, everything else in the magazine goes through a very, very elaborate editing process where things get written and rewritten, and of course it's still the person's work, but there's often a lot of hands in it. Here, you know, when you're looking at Roz Chask cartoon, it's Roz Chask. Nobody else wrote the line for her. Every once in a while, I'll make a suggestion, like with someone like Roz, if there's many panels, I'll say something like, you know, I think panel four is weak. You know, I think you could do a little bit more. It's more of encouragement. The people are very talented, and they want to come up with their ideas. See, I mean, in a caption, let's say, you know, 10 or 15 words, yeah, we'll change a word, but I don't want to really start rewriting it because then it becomes my work. And one of the things about the New Yorker cartoon, and when you're looking at it, it says, is it really the work of the person who does it. The editing, I think, primarily is in the selection and really in the criteria. It was very different at one time. When the magazine started out in the 30s and 40s, there was a lot more, not so much editing, but it's straight-out gag writing. People like Peter Arno, for the most part, didn't write any of their captions, or Helen Hokanson. Very, very few. So it might be one writer. It might be more like sort of a Broadway show model where someone does the music and someone, you know, does the lyrics.
So someone would come up with a gag and then the cartoonist would be brought in to come up with the image?
Yeah, but more collaborative than that. But,
they worked as teams.
But the roles were clearly assigned. Helen Hokanson might draw pictures and talk with her collaborator, and he might come up with lines, and they might go back and forth. But it was different than it is now.
My guest is Robert Mankoff, cartoon editor of The New Yorker and author of the new book, The Naked Cartoonist. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is cartoonist Robert Mankoff. He's the cartoon editor of The New Yorker magazine and author of the new book, The Naked Cartoonist. Who were some of your heroes when you were reading The New Yorker before you started working there?
Well, I, like everybody else, you know, Charles Adams and George Price. But I would say my main influence, although my cartoon certainly veered very, very far away from it, was Saul Steinberg. There was something so, and it was hardly to say even that they were cartoons, but there was something sort of so deeply intellectual about those cartoons, and I had quit graduate school to become a cartoonist, so Saul Steinberg was sort of my way station.
Can you give an example of one of his cartoons that influenced you?
Well, I think I'm trying to remember it. You know, he engaged in this wonderful sort of, you know, almost fake writing, very elaborate writing. And there's a guy at quite simple cartoon. It's a loan office, and there's this guy asking for the loan. And in the speech balloon that's coming out is all this elaborate writing, but it's all just shaped like a no. Almost like the Constitution, you know.
Right.
But in this wonderful and also you know and also very very. Artistic as well. And the elaborate pictures that really can't be summarized on the radio would just sort of spark my imagination and think, I guess what it made me think is that this was something you could aspire to, that something wonderful could be done in this field, that it could be more than just a joke or more than, you know, I had grown up drawing Donald Duck and Bugs Bunny in school, and it could sort of be... I mean, I quit graduate school, and I said, well, gee, the New Yorker could sort of be the Harvard of cartooning.
Now, you sold your first cartoon to the New Yorker in 1977. What were
Right.
some of the things that you drew before that didn't get in, that got your rejection notices?
Yeah, I did hundreds of cartoons, and I actually got a number of them published. I'm thinking of some of them now. One of them is it's in the book. It shows a gesture, and he's in a very gloomy cell. He's hanging by his hands, and he's peering out the window to the guard. And you know, it's a court jester, and he's saying, "Please tell the king I've remembered the punchline."
Yeah, I like that one.
then there's a couple, a middle-aged couple. They're just reading the paper in the living room, And you hear, you know, you see in the picture says it's not someone's knocking at the door, and the woman is saying to the man, quick, hide, that may be my husband.
That's a kind of variation on the no sex theme.
Right, it is. Yeah, yeah, it is. And when I look back on this, I mean, sometimes I flip that, you know, around, where you take a situation that is a very, very common situation, and then by somehow looking at it in a different way, like I might have a couple just at breakfast reading the paper, drinking coffee, and the woman might be saying, you know, Dave, I think the divorce has just been a little bit too amiable.
Of the rejection letters that you got when you were starting out, which is the one that really stands out in your mind?
Well, none of the New Yorkers, because this was the standard rejection slip. You know, thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to see it, which, you know, as I said, many people, not just me, created wallpaper out of. The one that stands out in my mind is one I got from Steve Heller, who was then, I think, the editor for the op-ed page of the New York Times, where they used art, the art editor, a cartoon historian and a fine editor and everything. But I got back this little note that said, we think your ideas are good, but we would like you to do them in a less cumbersome style. So, which I ignored. I persisted in my cumbersome style, but I think that's the one that I sort of remember.
Did you know what he meant by cumbersome style?
Yeah, because I've done do the stuff with the dots.
Uh-huh.
He wanted me to lose the dots, and I didn't know then why I did the, you know, did this stipple dot style. I don't exactly know why, except probably I'd been drawing this way in one way or another since high school. So there was something about that rejection letter that I sort of liked in a way, because it was asking me to do something that I knew I wasn't going to do. And so it sort of gave me, said, okay, well, I'm going to have to see if I can do it, you know, my way without the whole melodic interpretation Sinatra thing.
Now, in talking about rejection notices, in your new book, The Naked Cartoonist, you reprint a letter you got from David Mamet shortly after you became cartoon editor, and then you print the note you sent him in return.
Right.
So read us the two.
Well, David Mamet, I'll do this from memory. I think it's pretty
close. This is David Mamet, the screenwriter and playwright
and
director.
Right, the screenwriter. Well, and cartoonist, I guess, because he did cartoons, and I think he has published some cartoons. He sent me, he said, when I became cartoon editor, Dear Mr. Mankoff, congratulations on becoming a cartoon editor. I've taken the liberty of sending you a bunch of cartoons. And I looked at them, and I wrote him back this note saying, thanks very much. I've taken the liberty of sending you a play.
why did you do that?
Just snottiness. But partly.
Because it's really a way of saying to him, you may be a great writer, but your cartoons aren't very good. I mean,
let's put it more gently, not right for us. That's what I learned basically in being an editor. You don't say things are not good. You say they're not right for us.
Right.
There is a certain arrogance that writers have, often captured when they say this to you. I can't draw at all, but their assumption is somehow that they could easily, you know, create great cartoons because they're smart, they're writers, they're funny, and whatnot. And I haven't found it to be the case. Now, last week, Norman Mailer was in my office showing me his cartoons. And I must say, I was a lot nicer to Mr. Mailer than I was in this note to David Mamet. But they weren't actually cartoons, so I don't know if they didn't really fit the criteria so much, whereas actually David Mamet's cartoons were basically attempts to do gag cartoons. And, I mean, I judge them as unsuccessful. Others might think otherwise. I think the problem writers have, and even, you know, great writers, is that they bring all... It's almost like a tremendously muscle-bound person trying to play ping pong. They just bring in too much to it.
Mm-hmm.
They want to show off. They want to show not only are they funny, but they're smart. The other thing that happens, I don't know how to describe this, but even if their cartoons were okay, it would be hard to use them because the cartoons are become too contaminated by their other persona. so that people couldn't really even see the cartoon. The way I'd explain it is sort of by flipping it and say, let's say you look at Roz Chast cartoons, and if you look at them for 20 years, and these wonderful cartoons, and then you meet Roz Chast. Well, it's hard for you just to meet Roz. You're looking at her, but you're not even seeing her, or you are, you're seeing her, but it's somehow contaminated by all your preconceptions about her because of her cartoons. In the same way, if someone was, you know, very famous, I don't know, let's say George Bush started submitting cartoons to the New Yorker, it would be impossible just to view them as they should be viewed. I mean, if they were funny enough, I guess we'd publish it, and I am in, even right now over the radio encouraging George Bush to submit.
Well, who knows?
I know he's a busy guy, but look,
get
off the treadmill, draw a little bit.
Robert Mankoff is the cartoon editor of The New Yorker and author of the new book, The Naked Cartoonist. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Audi, the luxury car company with quattro all-wheel drive in every model line. Details at AudiUSA.com. By Harcourt, publisher of The Crimson Petal and the White, a novel of Victorian England by Michelle Faber, and Nonsuch Records and Travelogue, the new album by Joni Mitchell, a 2-CD set featuring new recordings of 22 songs spanning her entire career, accompanied by full orchestra, available at Barnes & Noble. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, cartoons about sex and not having sex. We continue our conversation with the cartoon editor of The New Yorker magazine, Robert Mankoff. Also, we meet two of the people behind the satirical newspaper The Onion, editor Robert Siegel and writer Carol Kolb. And John Powers reviews the new film Solaris, starring George Clooney. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Mankoff, cartoon editor of The New Yorker magazine. He got the job in 1997, 20 years after he sold his first cartoon to The New Yorker. He's edited several collections of the magazine's cartoons. Now he has a new book about the art and craft of cartooning called The Naked Cartoonist. In a recent edition of The New Yorker, there is a cartoon it's very funny. I thought I'd ask you about it. As our listeners may know, there's a new Museum of Sex in New York, and this cartoon showed exhibits from the Museum of No Sex, and the exhibits included the chastity belt, the headache, the pocket protector, Star Trek memorabilia, and late night television. Talk about deciding to use this particular comic.
Well, I mean, in a way, it's sort of like a common way to flip an idea. And another criteria, really, that I didn't mention is topicality. A cartoon like this, simply because it talks about this new subject, in a way, doesn't have to be the world's best cartoon. It just sort of interestingly flipped the idea of sex with no sex. I mean, one of the things that changed somewhat in The New Yorker, especially when Tina Brown started being editor, was that sex became a topic. One of the first cartoons I did when Tina became editor for her tenure was there was a couple, a middle-class couple in bed, and they're reading, and the woman is saying, you're right, tonight isn't reading night, tonight is sex night.
Right.
And in a way, both these cartoons have an affinity. One of the things is that, in sort of a subtextual way, this cartoon speaks to the fact that although we have a very sexualized culture, people aren't having much sex.
you have another cartoon about that, and it's there's four middle-aged people in a living room, one sitting on the couch, one's on an easy chair, another's on another easy chair, one's reading, one's listening to a Walkman, the other's knitting.
Right.
And what's the caption?
I think it's Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, the remake.
Yeah. And for anyone who doesn't know that movie, that's a movie about, like, swinging couples having sex with each other in the 60s or 70s, I forget which. So, yeah, I thought that was another funny one on that same theme,
people not
having sex.
Not having sex. And this is a little bit what I'm talking about as we're discussing these cartoons. You can see what the sort of bedrock criteria for what has become defined as a New Yorker cartoon is. It's topical, but it's not today topical. It's not this week topical. It's contemporary, but it is speaking to the issues of this time.
Can you think of funny ones about having sex?
About having sex. Let me say, I think I did a cartoon where there's a few cartoons. One I did where there's a woman and a man in bed, and they're actually having sex, New Yorker type sex. and sometimes I ask my wife, "You want to have New Yorker type sex or regular sex?" But the woman is saying to the man, "Wow, our first date, and already I feel like it's our second.
Right.
So the other thing I did, I mean, somewhat crazy sort of sex thing, is I did a cartoon where it's just two chairs stacked up, you know, like when you close a restaurant with one chair on top of the other, and it's called How Chairs Have Sex.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Mankoff. He's the cartoon editor for The New Yorker magazine, and he has a new book called The Naked Cartoonist. One of the things you've been doing at The New Yorker the past few years is having a captioning contest. Why don't you describe the contest?
The contest is... It happens every cartoon issue where we provide an image drawn by a cartoonist. When the cartoonist draws the image, he doesn't have any idea, or he doesn't have a completely thought-out idea of what the caption is actually going to be. And then we ask the readers of the magazine, this year we've done it all over the internet, to supply a caption. And the idea is somehow it's a little bit like a parlor game. It's like, it's not so much, well, can you make a great cartoon out of this, but can you really make any cartoon? It's quite hard because you, as the reader, don't have control over the picture at all. When I'm a cartoonist, I can draw a situation, and I can discard all the drawings that don't work until, you know, one sort of hits my mind is right. I mean, I can start drawing a couple, and I can have the couple on either side of a couch, and I can put guns in their hand, and I can have them shooting at each other, and I can have the guy on the phone while this couple is shooting each other, and he's on the phone and saying, as a matter of fact, you did call us at a bad time. But I get to control all the elements to make that gag work. So it's harder, and that's why I think it's quite remarkable that the readers of the magazine come up with some pretty good lines for the weird pictures that we throw at them.
You want to describe the picture that was in the most recent version of this in 2002?
Yeah, it's got it's a prison cell, sort of a hard-bitten prisoner, and on the lower bunk is an angel who is very sad, and he's got his head in his hands in a woebegone look. And that's sort of the picture. And the idea is that this picture should create some sort of tension. I mean, what is an angel doing in prison? Is it an angel? He's got a little, you know, and there's all little objects, this little pin-up picture. The convict is talking to the angel. And the question is, you know, what is it that he's going to say that's going to be funny?
As we record this, you haven't picked a winner yet. Can
right.
you tell what some of the lines you're considering, or at least some of the lines that have come in are?
Sure. One of those, a convict, you know, talking to the angel and saying, I think I could borrow that outfit for the parole meeting. There's a couple of long lines of, yeah, the devil made me do it, too. or some guardian angel you turned out to be.
All right.
Just for discussion's sake, how far do you think you could carry a guy?
That's good.
And
are
so those, are
these contenders or?
Yeah, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
And they're quite good.
Yeah.
You know, they're quite good, and I in one way it points out to the great readers of the magazine, and it also points out why the cartoons are this democratic form, because people really can relate to them. You often can come up with a good line for a cartoon, maybe not, you know, in a professional way. Maybe if you had to do 10 or 20 a week, you know, you wouldn't be able to do it, but people feel a natural connection to cartoons because they think, sometimes realistically, sometimes unrealistically, that they could do them.
After September 11th, how long did it take The New Yorker to feel like it was comfortable or that it was appropriate to publish cartoons that had to do with terrorism?
I think we took a week where we just stepped back. We had one George Booth drawing, which wasn't a cartoon, sort of an anti-cartoon. It just showed one of his usually gay, happy figures, depressed. Miss Ritterhouse, she had her violin, but she wasn't playing any music, and the cat just had the head between his hands. But the week after, we sort of edged back into it. The first cartoon we ran after September 11th was a woman saying to a guy at a bar, saying, "Yeah, I never thought I'd laugh again until I saw that jacket." it's got and it showed wonderfully. It showed wonderfully, really well. We were going to laugh. People were going to be silly and stupid. And then there was a great cartoon, which is still applicable, is that woman getting on a plane with a cat and a little cat carrier, and a security guy saying, "Ma'am, we're going to have to declaw the cat."
That's good.
So I think we did a pretty good job. Of course, it wasn't about, we didn't do cartoons about the tragic part of it. We did cartoons about the human part and what we were after September 11th, which were still people.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. Thanks for having me. It was really my pleasure. Whenever you get to New York, come and visit me at The New Yorker. I'd love to show you the place.
I'm glad you said that because I have a few cartoons I wanted to show you. I'm kidding.
Not
don't worry. don't
and,
worry.
And I have
I
a few interviews, of course, I'd like to do.
Robert Mankoff is the cartoon editor of The New Yorker and the author of the new book, The Naked Cartoonist. Coming up, two of the people behind the satirical newspaper, The Onion. This is Fresh Air. The Onion is a satirical newspaper that lampoons the latest headlines and all aspects of politics and American culture. A recent headline read, "Bush seeks UN support for U.S. does whatever it wants plan." The article reads, "President Bush called upon the international community to support his U.S. does whatever it wants plan, which would permit the U.S. to take any action it wishes anywhere in the world at any time." The headline was written by my guest, Carol Kolb. Also with us is The Onion's editor, Robert Siegel. The Onion is published on the Internet and has a hard copy edition, but you can also catch up on The Onion through its book collections. The latest is called The Onion Ad Nauseam, and it collects all the articles published during The Onion's 13th year, from October 2000 to October 2001. I asked them for some of their favorite recent Onion headlines.
One that I wrote recently was, "India's top physicist develop plan to get the hell out of India." They're just got together, figured out what to do to leave. Also another one, "Republicans mount campaign to rename Alzheimer's Reagan's disease."
Ooh, yeah.
That was a good one. I like that one a lot.
Yeah.
We also had a headline recently, "Bush won't stop asking Cheney if we can invade yet."
Right, yeah.
He couldn't stop bugging about that. And then Cheney had a recent op-ed, which was, "When I'm feeling blue, I can always go to my undisclosed location." And it was sort of his own personal treehouse bunker where he goes when he's kind of sad.
Do you have, like, brainstorming sessions at the beginning of the week in which everybody throws in their headlines and people bounce off of that? Or do people just bring that to you, Rob, since you're the editor? Is that a more group thing or a more private
thing?
No,
it's a group. Well, it's a private thing. The brainstorming is private. Everyone comes up with 25 headlines every week, and then they're read collectively. We get together in a room, and we pitch our ideas, and the ideas that get a good response go on a master list, and then from there, there's a multi-step winnowing process.
Right.
The first step is to pitch your ideas to the group, and the ideas that are liked, then go to the next stage.
And you would be surprised how unfunny those meetings are. We just sort of sit around in a room. We all read our headlines, and we're tired, and we want to go home. And there actually is not all that much laughing. We're just sort of like, yeah, that'll work. Okay.
I mean, there are moments of laughter and inspiration, but we really, it sounds, if you were to observe an Onion meeting, it would look a lot more like probably a Washington Post editorial meeting where it's just everything's being very soberly discussed, even though what we're discussing is not all that serious. We actually, at this point, having done it for most of the staff has been there 7, 8, 9 years at this point, and we can do it in this very sober, intellectualized way that really comes off as really funny and ridiculous to an outside observer.
What's the one story that has gotten the biggest reaction from, well, two things. What's the story that's gotten the biggest reaction because people loved it, and the story that's gotten the biggest reaction because people were offended by it or thought it was in bad taste?
Let's see.
I remember
the Ashley Olsen op-ed was.
Yeah, sometimes it's kind of random. Someone will pick up a story and either think that it's real, or even if they don't, they just become offended and they send it out through emails and distribute it, and then we'll get an onslaught of negative email. And recently, that happened with an article. Do you remember the headline, Rob?
I think it was "Mary Kate Olsen is dragging Ashley down." This woman was a big fan. They're twins, and this woman was a big fan of one of the twins and not the other. It's just one of these things where fans who don't get the, it's usually just fans who don't get the joke. It's not like the most offensive article we've ever run. There's not necessarily a correlation between level of offensiveness and level of outrage in the response we get. Usually it's just these random weird articles. The ones we least expect are going to be the ones that somehow get, you know, the fans or the people who care about that particular thing, whatever it
right,
is.
Right.
They mobilize, and you never know what it's going to be.
Right.
Right. Okay. So, sometimes it's a legitimately offensive one. I remember one was I wrote it. It was sudden infant death syndrome linked to bad parents who should have done more. Yeah, and so, you know, it's just an article that took all the quotes of the parents who, you know, why couldn't I have done something? What, you know, reported these as fact. And I remember getting some emails from people, and they were saying, "Well, don't you understand that these people are, you know, are feeling grief and wrongly feeling guilt, and that, you know, and that's why they're giving these answers, you know?" And they pretty much just explained the premise of the humor to us
exactly
in their email.
That's
exactly
a standard onion formula, is to take the terrible attitude some people have, you know, the absolute opposite of what psychologists tell you you're supposed to say or think about something, and then report it. So that was a case. If you're on Yahoo and you're doing a search, let's say, for example, your child died of sudden infant death syndrome, you do a Yahoo search for a support group in your neighborhood. Our article, Onion articles.
Yeah.
That's how many of our readers come to us is, right. or certainly our irate readers come to us, is they'll do a search on Yahoo or Google for a particular subject, and our horrible article about that subject will turn up.
Oh God!
You know, embedded in the so the right. critical reader, you'd think if you were if you had critical reading skills, you would say, what is the context of this article?
Right.
What is the source? You know, and then you might be able to figure out that the Onion is, not real, but they don't always do that. You know, most people just see something in print, and there's something about print that people, particularly, you know, news print, that people, you know, people are very gullible.
Oh yeah, but still, you know, like say you did lose a child, and you're researching sudden infant death syndrome, and you come across the article.
Well, that's
you're
a case
not,
where
you're not in the mood for. I mean, you're
right.
not. You're not
well,
in the mood to be entertained. You're doing it because you're miserable.
Course. And that's,
so I can understand how people would take it the wrong way. And it's
no,
just,
that's not a case.
Yeah.
Right.
It also happens in this other way where people sort of use our articles to justify the thoughts that they already have. Like we got a lot of email for an article we did about homosexual recruitment drive up to anticipated levels.
It's like 1998. Yeah. 1998 homosexual. Recruitment drive nearing goal or something.
Yeah, and so a lot of people found that article and
a lot of gay it went up on a lot of gay hate group, you know, gay
like it was real.
Right.
Yeah, saying look at what the gays are doing.
Right. Or we have articles about fake products, and we sort of just think of some product that the disgusting American public would want. And one was a stop smoking product that was smokable nicotine sticks, and you know, basically it was just cylindrical. It was a cigarette.
Like instead of a patch, which has a little dose of nicotine,
right.
you can actually have a
yeah.
cylindrical tube
right.
that you insert into your mouth.
But
orally.
You got a prescription from your doctor, and we got some emails.
That
said that people were asking about these. That they heard about them. They read an article. They wanted to know where they could get them.
Yeah. One of the funniest along those lines was we had an article, Chinese woman gives birth to septuplets. It was right after remember the McCoy septuplets in Iowa who gave birth to the 8 children? We did one, Chinese woman gives birth to septuplets, and then the subhead was, has 1 week to choose. And the idea was in accordance with Chinese one child per family policy, this woman had to pick which of the 8 children.
Right. And throw the others off a cliff.
Yeah, the others had to be thrown off a mountaintop. So we got all sorts of emails from people, not mad at us, but mad at the Chinese government for this horrible policy. And we had offers to adopt the children, the unwanted children. And we had people just simply writing to inform us that they had started a prayer group for the kids. Most of those emails, curiously, came from Texas for whatever reason.
Do you feel like you have to respond to these these emails where they don't get the context, they don't get the joke, and they're angry with you? Do you write them back?
No, we don't.
We occasionally, I think, someone might send back just a statement that says, you know, the Onion is a satirical newspaper, but in general, we just do not respond.
For the most part, we regard those people as lost causes. Mm-hmm. We're not going to. I don't think we're going to convert them into Onion fans. You know, so I guess we've got other things to do.
Robert Siegel is the editor of The Onion. Carol Kolb writes for The Onion. The Onion is published on the internet at theonion.com. The new Onion book is called The Onion Ad Nauseam. Coming up, John Powers reviews the new movie Solaris. This is Fresh Air. Director Steven Soderbergh and actor George Clooney team up again in the new sci-fi film Solaris. Clooney starred in Soderbergh's films Out of Sight and Ocean's 11. Soderbergh also made the box office hits Traffic and Aaron Brockovich. Soderbergh adapted Solaris from Andrei Tarkovsky's 1972 film, which was based on a novel by Stanislav Lem. Film critic John Power says Soderbergh and Clooney have made a big-budget art film full of surprises.
Back in 1972, the anti-Soviet Russian filmmaker Andrei Tarkovsky made Solaris, a fabled art film that was something of a response to Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, which Tarkovsky found technically brilliant but inhuman. Tarkovsky's movie has an international cult following, and when it was first announced that Steven Soderbergh was doing a remake, a man followed him down the streets of New York shrieking, "You should be ashamed!" No, he shouldn't. Clocking in at a lean 96 minutes, Soderbergh's bold new remake is an honorably told tale of love, loss, memory, and redemption. George Clooney stars as Chris Kelvin, a disillusioned shrink who spent years grieving for his dead wife, Rhea. One day, he receives an enigmatic call for help from a space station near Solaris, a swirling oceanic planet which is essentially a gigantic brain. Reaching the station, he finds the place deserted, except for a jittery geek named Snow, played by Jeremy Davies, and a stolid scientist named Gordon, played by Viola Davis. Kelvin soon learns that Solaris has the ability to bring human memories to life, and as he snoozes, his dead wife Rhea, that's Natasha McElhone, shows up in his room. Freaked out, he activates a space pod and banishes the simulacrum into deep space. But Rhea keeps coming back and back, and Kelvin starts sleeping with her, wondering whether he can save the new Rhea to atone for not keeping his wife from suicide back on Earth. Here, Gordon confronts Kelvin about what they should do with the duplicate Rhea.
She's a mirror that reflects part of your mind. You provide the formula.
She's alive.
She is not human. Try to understand that if you can understand anything.
What about your visitor? The one that you're so ready to destroy without hesitation. Who is it? What is it? Does it feel? Can it touch? Does it speak?
We are in a situation that is beyond morality. Your wife is dead.
Although this version of Solaris is far more accessible than the original, it is, by current Hollywood standards, almost avant-garde, elliptical, open-ended, and demanding on viewers who are used to having everything spelled out. It's an especially daring project for both Soderbergh and Clooney, hugely successful figures who previously worked together on Out of Sight and Ocean's 11, which are enjoyable movies, but not exactly known for their weightiness. Here, each pushes himself farther than he's ever gone before. The movie is a triumph for Clooney, who has always seemed a present-day version of Cary Grant or Clark Gable, an old-style movie star better known for his virile charm than his inner depth. But as Kelvin, he achieves a revealing new level of passion. In fact, for a guy who spent his entire career playing cool, Clooney's strikingly good at acting scared, freaked out, and emotionally ravaged. Ironically, he's at his worst in the rather trite flashbacks that depict Kelvin first falling for Rhea, precisely the scenes that come closest to asking him to do Clooney. The movie is propelled along by Soderbergh's style, which owes more to the European 1960s than it does to today's Hollywood. In fact, the story feels positively dreamlike, a quality played up in the film's striking imagery, with its hallucinatory crispness, symbolic battle between gold and blue, and use of shifting focus to give shapes an ambiguous fluidity. But while the style is something of a tour de force, the technique is worthy of Kubrick, it doesn't wholly mesh with the feelings it's supposed to express. Although I could tell the love between Kelvin and Rhea was supposed to be moving, I kept feeling their passion struggling against the virtuosity of Soderbergh's filmmaking, which is so worked that even when he wants scenes to be emotionally incandescent, they wind up feeling detached, even chilly. Unlike Todd Haynes in Far From Heaven, Soderbergh doesn't quite escape the prison house of his own intelligence and make us feel for his characters. At one point in the original Russian film, a character says, "We have lost our sense of the cosmic." That loss is felt acutely in this remake, which suffers from a fascinating culture clash at its very core. Soderbergh has taken a story that feels very Eastern European, shot through with agonized romanticism and a transcendent sense of spirituality, and then heroically tried to make it fit within the profoundly secular constraints of Hollywood filmmaking. But in the end, this is a movie that yearns for transcendence more than it's able to deliver it. Soderbergh's film never achieves the cosmic resonance of the original, which you can now see on a marvelous new DVD from Criterion. Still, its failings are born of ambition rather than commercial calculation. And rather like the fictive Rhea that Kelvin finds out in space, Solaris may not be the real thing, but you can almost believe that it is.
John Powers writes the On column for LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music by Jimi Hendrix. Today would have been his 60th birthday.
Well, I'm standing here freezing inside your golden garden. I've got my ladder leaned up against your wall. Tonight's the night we plan to run away together. Come on, dolly me. Think about a way till tomorrow.
Think about a way till tomorrow.
Now, what you talking about?
Think about a way till tomorrow.
Gotta make sure it's right. So, until tomorrow, good night. Oh, golly, babe, how can you hang me up this way? On the phone, you said you wanted to run up with me today. Standing here like some turned down serenading fool, hearing strange words stuttered from the mixed up mind of you. And you keep telling me that think about a way till tomorrow.
Think about a way till tomorrow.
No, can't wait that long.
Think about a way till tomorrow.
Oh, no. Gotta make sure it's right until tomorrow. Good night.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Cloud of Sparrows, a debut novel of 19th century Japan by Takashi Matsuoka, and Find Law, offering an online directory of more than 1 million attorneys, plus consumer and business legal guides, providing a place to find answers, find lawyers, find law. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, some laughs for Thanksgiving. We feature interviews with Jerry Seinfeld, Gary Shandling, and Jay Leno. They're featured in the new documentary Comedian about Seinfeld's return to stand-up comedy. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.